I popped myself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips of popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. This is another in our series of Water Hill retrospective episodes where we talk about the films Water Hill. This is 1981 Southern Comfort. There are going to be full spoilers for this movie. This is an action thriller. So this is the kind of movie, it's probably better to watch it before you listen. There are a couple things you could get spoiled on in this movie, I guess.
Yeah.
You should be able to find it streaming. It's out there. It's pretty easy to find. So I do recommend you try to watch it first. But that said, we're going to get into it. I have a co-host today. My co-host is Carl from The Geomologist Presents. How are you doing, Carl?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to looking at and examining, dissecting, that's a foreshadowing, Southern Comfort, the 1981 film by Walter Hill.
Great. Thank you for joining me for this. I had sent you a list of movies. I was very happy when you picked Southern Comfort. Had you seen this before?
I thought I did, and I probably saw it because I feel like this was one of those movies that was on HBO a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think I got it. I think I got it, you know, back in the 80s when we first got cable, you know, and had the you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
People. Younger people like Joe Richter won't understand that sound. But anyway, so I think I got it confused with Deliverance because I was waiting for Ned Beatty to come on and say, squeal like a pig. But I think that's Deliverance, not Southern Comfort. But they might be a little similar in like plot. So I might try to go back and look up Deliverance too.
Deliverance is definitely worth a. It's outside the scope of today's episode, but it's definitely worth a rewatch. There are some strong performances in Deliverance. Definitely disturbing in a couple areas, but it's a good movie. But that said, there's no doubt on probably the influence of it in the desire to make a movie like this. In fact, Deliverance is even mentioned in the trailer for this movie. They even mentioned the movie Deliverance.
Interesting.
Because they're trying to draw on that audience, fans of that movie.
I feel like there was another movie that was similar to this too. And it was by John Borman. I think The Emerald Forest or something like that.
Well, Borman did Deliverance.
Oh, Borman did Deliverance. Okay. Yeah. So that's probably why. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's next year. I don't know.
Maybe. We'll
then we could do Excalibur with that one, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
We'll see. But now this one. So Water Hill was doing pretty good, but he had a writing partner that he always worked with, David Geller. And they had gotten a number of scripts, including Alien, which, you know, he worked on the script for that, the writing process, not the film.
David Geller or Walter Hill?
Both, actually. Both.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. But this one is one that Walter Hill helped do the script and directed. And for this series, I'm doing just films that he directed. Yeah. He had already worked in Louisiana in Hard Times, where they did the boxing movie in New Orleans with Chuck Bronson. And so they put this movie together. And, funny enough, it didn't do very well in the States, really. And we'll talk about this maybe at the very end after we talk about the movie. The only place this really did well was in Iran. It probably cut even everywhere else. But it was a hit in Iran, and we'll talk about that at the end.
Maybe we could talk about that. That's a little funny, actually.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But I mean, this was a tough shoot, right? They shot for 55 days.
Looks like it.
Yeah, they shot for 55 days in the winter in the Louisiana swamp.
Oh,
they
my God.
On location. And that, you know, you read stories and you see interviews of these actors, and the actor said Water Hill did a great job keeping people's keeping their spirits up, and he let them go home for Christmas and things like that. But the problem was the cameras, like you'd set up the cameras and the stands would sink in the swamp, and And it was just a miserable shoot. And you can watching, but I think it pays off because as you watch this movie, it feels real. You know, you see the scenery and you can tell they're not on a soundstage. They're actually there in the swamp, you know, tromping through the water and dealing with the misery. And so I think that was the right choice to shoot it in the swamp, even though, you know, it was a grueling shoot for everybody involved.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you get, I mean, that's amazing too, because I think, I'm sure there is a lot of like filming that they had to get rid of through the editing process, but they did a great job of editing because you cannot tell if the problems you outline, if those are a few of them, you can't really tell how the look of the movie is pretty nice, pretty realistic, pretty seamless. There are no bouncing cameras around, for example, if that indeed happened, or cameras sinking into the water, or even water on the lens. And so, you know, they really did a good job of, you know, on the cutting room floor, I think, given all these problems that arose.
No, I agree. He, for the music for this, it's done by Ry Cooder or Cooter.
Oh, neat.
Cooter. He's the same guy that did The Long Riders, which, you know, is another great Water Hill movie, which actually is another movie that Keith Carradine was in. It was
interesting.
That was the first time Keith worked with Hill, but, and, you know, cause that came out the year prior, but you know, I think the soundtrack, it's kind of understated, you know, it never overwhelms, but I think it fits very well. And I think the soundtrack's a definitely a plus to the movie.
I agree. It definitely is evocative. There's no music in the background. Sometimes when the tension builds up, there's music. And then I guess I definitely, you know, Ry Cooder looks like he got some Zydeco players as well, because there's that kind of Cajun music influence in there as well. So, and that's pretty neat. I'm sure we'll get to talking about that too. I thought it was good. It was not, you always want a soundtrack to be evocative, and I agree, understated is a great term. You don't want it to overwhelm the film or get in the way or distract, right? You want it to be evocative and complement what's going on in the scenes. So I think Ry Cooder did a really good job with that.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. There's a whole lot more to say about it. I mean, it's not necessarily something you're going to take and download and put in the car and listen to while you're driving. But
well, maybe the Zydeco. I like that kind of music.
Yeah. Well, I kind of do too, to some degree. But like I say, I think it's a good soundtrack for the movie. And like we talked about, the cinematography is well done. There's a couple slow motion shots in here that I'm not a huge slow motion guy, but we'll talk about that when we get to the end here. But for the most part,
Zack Snyder would be upset at you for saying that.
Oh, what's that?
Zack Snyder is upset at you for saying that. He doesn't like slow motion shots.
He'll get over it. But for the most part, I don't have anything. I mean, it's not, there's nothing crazy in here. There's no like, you know, special wipes or anything really outstanding, but it's a solid movie. And even today, you know, what, 40 years later, I think it still looks good and it still works.
And it moves pretty, I feel like it moves pretty well. There's some parts they probably could have cut out. I will say in general, there's a lot of running through the water that they could have cut out a little bit. But for the most part, it moves pretty well. I mean, there's definitely, I feel like a lot of movies of this type of thriller genre or military action genre that drag in points because it's just bloated, but this one moves pretty well. I don't remember the length.
Does.
Was it so? Was the length was it?
So it's an hour 45, and when we look at the movie, right? We've got within 10 minutes. The first 10 minutes, we're introduced to the squad, to the men.
Yeah,
about 20 minutes in, Staff Sergeant Poole shot. 30 minutes in is when they get to the cabin where they meet Byron James, right? And 45 minutes in is when we come across those rabbits, and shortly afterwards they're attacked by the hunting dogs. An hour in, we have the knife fight between Reese and Harden. An hour 20, we're down to just Harden, Spencer, and the coach is the only characters left. And the last part of the movie, I think, is pretty suspenseful. We'll talk about that when they get to the little settlement. So it does move pretty quickly, and they do a couple things to help. There's one scene, they only do it once, but I really like, pretty early on in it, this is after Lieutenant's shot and after they're on the move, or the Sass aren't shot and they're on the move. But they, at one point, they do a thing where they've got doing a dialogue scene and they're talking, but it's you see their heads transparent, and the squad is moving through the swamp in the background. So it's kind of like overlaid. The talking is overlaid them moving
through while they're moving. Yeah, I like
that, which I really liked.
I feel like they did that a little bit too, and I thought it was really neat. I mean, I don't know if this was a trend, but you see it a lot in like the Bond films that they have a pre-credit action, right? And I really, that's why I thought the introduction of all the National Guardsmen and the all the characters were introduced like pre-credit, right? So they all introduce, they meet everyone. There's a little, there's a little tension. There's a history between some of the squad members in this Louisiana National Guard unit. And then you get to the credits as soon as they get their mission, or the sergeant pool gives them the mission. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do, guys, for the weekend. And then they cut to the swamp scenes and the credits. I thought that was really a really neat technique to introduce all the characters, right in a tight space, because there are a lot of characters to keep track of, really. So I thought that was a cool technique to do that.
Yeah, they do a great job with that. And even during, and we, like I say, it kind of does move, because even during that credit scene, when they start off in the swamp, we see Reese cutting the fishing nets, right away in the credits. So our tension and our conflict is set immediately. Now, mentioned
like, I saw that. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is how it begins.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
And so we mentioned our people, right? So let's meet our squad.
Let's go to the cast. Quick. Yeah.
Yeah. So the lead here is Keith Carradine, and he's been acting for about 10 years now. He's Spencer in this. Yep. And Keith Carradine
PFC
is
Spencer. Yep.
Yeah. He's interesting because, so Hill said that he was, I'm going to read a quick quote here from what Walter Hill said about Carradine's character. He was one of nature's aristocrats, grateful, confident in his own ability, and able to separate himself from other people with an amusing remark. In contrast to Powers Booth's character, Powers Booth played Hardin, who Hill said is much more rational, hardworking, self-made individual, and as a result, cannot believe the nature of the situation at first, where Carradine can, because Carradine kind of takes everything a little bit lighter.
And that's definitely shown in the intro, because Carradine has like post-operation party. He's already set that up, right?
Yeah,
he's definitely like the life of the party, and that kind of guy. He's that guy. Probably was in a frat in college, I don't think he went to college, but he would be in a frat if he were in college. Whereas Powers Booth is like you said, a hardworking individual.
He's a chemical engineer.
Chemical engineer, gone through education, stuff like that. So are two main characters. I like Powers Booth a lot. The late Powers Booth. I loved him in the Deadwood series.
Yeah, he's great.
Other things. Yeah. Oh, Tombstone, classic.
Yeah, he's great. Great actor. No, he was with. He did other things. Water Hill, Extreme Prejudice. He's great in. This is a really early Powers Booth. Like I say, Carradine been acting for about 10 years. He's a known quantity. Powers Booth. This is maybe like his third thing. So he's pretty new, coming into this. Another new actor was Fred Ward. Of course, we lost Fred Ward recently as well. Right. Everybody knows Fred Ward from, Tremors and Remo Williams and all that stuff. But he plays Reese, and he's kind of I love Carradine when he's breaking the squad down. He like tries to buddy up with Hardin, who's Spencer tries to get with Hardin and buddy up. But when he explains the different men, he goes that Reese thinks he's in a dime store novel, and Stucky isn't smart enough to read a dime store novel. And that's
because those are the buddies, right?
In that one sentence, it's great.
And that's all the pre-credit scenes too. That's just great. That's when they're introducing everyone, right? So,
it's great. We've seen a lot of these actors before. Peter Coyote, you've seen before. Franklin Seals, T.K. Carter, of course, Byron James. This is like an early movie. Not that early role for him. He's been around for a little while at this point. Yeah. Byron James, of course, is in a ton of stuff. Interestingly enough, another hunter who doesn't get any lines in the movie, I don't think, another one of the Cajuns, is Sonny Landham, who we see in Predator. He's of course the tracker, Billy Soul in Predator.
I recognized him.
It's a good cast.
Yeah. And we have Les Landon as Casper and Carlos Brown as Bowden. I think that's what we got.
Carlos Brown is the other one that people definitely recognize, of course, from In the Heat of the Night, where you know he did that, and then he had played football, of course. He was he played football under the name Carlos Brown, which is also he's acting here. Carlos Allen Autry Jr. is his full name.
Right.
But yeah, so people are gonna recognize him. You know, he played for the Packers. So our buddy Eric would be familiar with him. But yeah, great cast, I think.
It's a really good cast, and a lot of except for Keith Carradine, a lot of them early in their career. That's pretty neat to see. I did not recognize Peter Coyote at first, so that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, and I think they're all strong performances. I don't think there's really a weak performance in here. I think they all do a pretty good job.
Yeah, everyone gets some good lines. They get a little bit of spotlight, you know. So good GM. Walter Hill's a good GM.
Yeah,
gives all the different, because there's a lot of characters in this adventure, right?
Although, like I say, 20 minutes in, we start weeding them out. So
yeah,
they're with the National Guard. They're supposed to move and get to the other end of the swamp here to rendezvous with the other people in their unit, their squad. But they come across this flooded out area and they can't cross it. But on the edge, there's this Cajun hunting camp. Nobody's there, but they find this Cajun hunting camp with, you know, they've got various skins hanging, and there's a deer that just been shot. And there are also some canoes there.
Pirogues, they call them pirogues.
Yeah. Yep. And they have this internal argument, and we can see the struggle for power. You know, you have Staff Sergeant Poole, who's in charge. Sergeant Casper's your assistant squad leader. And even though Carradine or Spencer is only a PFC, obviously he's a natural leader, and he holds a lot of weight in there, even though he doesn't have the rank. But there's a push back and forth. Reese is also, you know, a forceful personality, and Reese wants to steal the canoes right away. And like I said, Carlos, who plays Coach doesn't want anything to do with that. Coach is like, no, they're not ours.
It's a bad idea, right? Yeah.
But eventually go ahead.
You know, one thing we should note, this is a National Guard unit. They're not, you know, like a frontline military unit. It is alluded to that some have like military experience, fought in Vietnam. It does take place in 1973.
Right.
So I think something that is interesting just as a setup is that it is a movie about National Guardsmen. So I think maybe it didn't do so well because National Guardsmen had been in the spotlight, you know, at least during this time period, right, with the Kent State and desegregation. So I think people still, and then, you know, 1981, you know, Reagan had just been elected, really a lot of hoorah type sentiment towards the military. So a movie that kind of shows like a not so pleasant aspect or an aspect with a bad history in the military, maybe that's why it didn't do so great. But also they go into it's an exercise. So they go into the woods with blanks. So they don't have, you know, ammo.
Right. And that's something else that's set up in the pre-credits is that they all have blanks. And they set up some characterization for the other characters. But they do a good job, I think, of differentiate each of the characters here.
Yeah,
but
I think so, too.
They have this argument. Eventually, the part of the squad convinces the staff sergeant, we're only going to take three of the canoes. We're going to leave a note to let them know what happened to their canoes, you know, where they can come get them. Which is still, you know, a bad idea. They've cut the nets, and now they're stealing their canoes, right?
Yeah.
Well, they start paddling out, and they see them. Stucky sees some of these Cajun hunters on the shore.
Yeah.
And they try to holler to them to say, "We've got your boats." They're not getting any kind of response back. Mm-hmm. And as a joke, Stucky, like you say, has blanks. He fires the M60 machine gun at them.
Yeah.
Of course, the hunters dive for cover.
And they don't know.
Turn fire, self-defense, and they kill Staff Sergeant Poole with that first shot.
Yeah. And then all hell, then that's when all hell breaks out. They panic, right? So they failed their coolness under fire check, as you could probably allude to. I already have in mind what game I would use for this. But they failed their coolness under fire check. They panic. The canoes overspill, and they have to, like, slog through the swamp. And I think this is where they start. They're like wet the whole time after this. They're right. Like there's no yeah. no dry at all after this.
They we should know. Swamp. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, they slog through the swamp, recover Pool's body, and then start having an argument. And that's when you start seeing the two camps start breaking up with like a Reese-led camp and a Spencer-led camp.
Right. And they had hit before, but now we really yeah. see it. So mm-hmm. we should point out the coach is the one that really caused everybody to fall. So he dives out of his canoe when Pool gets shot. And when he tries to climb in the other canoe, he tips it. And really, it's Coach's fault that they all end up in the water. Just all three.
Yeah, they start finger pointing. Right, everyone's
right. And during that, where they're all in the water, Poole was holding the map when he got shot, so the map's gone. Unfortunately, because the PR-24, the radio, because the weight of it, Harden gets it off the back of the radio man, so he doesn't drown. And mm-hmm. then Reese, I think it had the compass, and Reese dropped the compass in the water too.
Yes.
So they lost all their stuff. Their compass, their map, and their radio.
Just a series of bad rolls.
Yeah. The other thing we see at this point, while they're recovering, so Reese is watching on guard while they recover the body, and we see Reese pull out. He's got a box of real ammunition, and he switches out his blanks for. So they only have 20 rounds. He only has 20 rounds. He has a box of ammunition. Yeah. But he reloads his magazine with live rounds.
Right.
They have an argument, like you say, the two camps knock heads, and Sergeant is able to get control of the situation enough, Sergeant Casper, mm-hmm. that he tells them, we're going to carry Poole's body out of here. So they make a litter up, and they're carrying the body. And here's where we get in the arguments of whose fault it is. Obviously, it's Stuckey's fault for firing the mm-hmm. blanks, these guys, right?
But they're all culpable because they stole the boats.
Well, the canoes, really, yeah, exactly. And I mean, but here we start hearing Reese talk about planning. We need to get revenge against these guys that shot Poole, right? Yeah. So that's building up. They end up stopping. So even though you have an NCO still, you still have a sergeant here. This isn't squad leader. He doesn't have good control.
They're all National Guardsmen. They're all like civilians in normal life. So they're not used to like a regimented, you know, all the time under command. And this is now a tense situation. So it's clear that I think it's a really interesting study. It is clear that, you know, command leadership breaks down. Right. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of something interesting to examine in this movie, how the leadership, the inexperience of Casper, you know, how Poole kind of held these disparate type of personalities together. He gets taken out right away. And then, you know, now it's like, it's starting to devolve, you know, into like an anarchic situation. I think that's pretty cool. Yeah. At some point, I think Harden finds out that Reese has live ammo. He forces him at knife point to give it up, and Casper divides it evenly among the soldiers, so everyone has like two real shots or something like that. It's
right,
it's silly.
Yeah.
It's silly. It's really silly. I mean,
well, I don't know if that's silly. I mean, they come out. They're sitting around. Actually, somebody else mentioned about because they all knew. Harden didn't know because he's new.
Oh yeah, they probably. I think even his buddy gives him up, or someone gives him up. Oh yeah, Reese always brings ammo for hunting.
Right, and Casper didn't know, and Casper's like, well, you need to spread that out, and. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Reese is going to do it. And he's actually, you know, they have this tense standoff, and Harden is snuck around and holds him at gunpoint, at which point Casper, distributes that ammo.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting though.
It seems like a reasonable, it seems like a reasonable order to distribute the ammo like that. But it's like a comedy. I mean, I guess it's a comedy of errors. I guess that's what I mean by silly. It's more like, it's like, as a viewer, you're like rolling your eyes. Like this seems like a logical idea, but it's a bad idea.
But
it's also the limited resources, right?
Yeah. But you can understand why Reese wouldn't want to give it up. If they're not smart enough to bring their own ammo, then screw them.
Right.
You've got, but at this point, they know you have these Cajun hunters out there that are after them. Shooting
with big hunting guns. Like,
yeah, with rifles. And do you want to, so at that point, if you have ammo, are you going to give some of it to other people, or are you going to keep it all to you only have 20 shots. So you're going to try to keep all that for yourself. That's all Reese.
Especially if you feel like you're like the best shot out there.
Right. Yeah. So it's, but yeah, so we have these tensions going on. Obviously Reese and Harden are bumping heads and all too.
Right.
So it, Well, okay. So the next thing, real big thing that happens, mm-hmm. really, is they come up to a cabin, this trapping cabin, and mm-hmm. we meet Byron Jones. Now everybody knows Byron Jones, you know, from, I guess the first big thing he did that everybody would know him from would be Blade Runner, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he's one of the synthetics in Blade Runner, but he's in tons of stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's there as a one-armed trapper. But they're like, he's the one that shot Poole. Well, this one-armed guy probably didn't do this 100-yard rifle shot, right?
No, I know he didn't.
but they're like, we have to capture. And this is where you see how Sergeant Casper really he'll quote military manuals and stuff, but he's like, we need to capture him. He's the enemy. And take this crazy plan they're going to capture. Of course, Reese just wants to kill him.
Yeah.
So they make up this plan where they're going to try to capture him and interrogate him, right? And then Coach loses it and charges forward. And
yeah, because like Poole was his buddy. Like Poole was his buddy, right?
Yeah. And so they get him and they're trying to interrogate him. Well, you only speak French, you know, like French Creole. So nobody can communicate with him.
Yeah.
And at this point, things devolve, you know, where, you know, we see, who is it? I think it's Cribs or Sims. No, it's Sims. Sims butt strokes mm-hmm. the trapper. You know, they're trying to talk to him. Everybody's frustrated. And at this point, Coach loses it. He just breaks.
Yeah.
And well, I'll let you to. So what happens with Coach when he breaks?
So Coach, like, you know, Coaches whose buddy was pooled. Apparently they had like a good friendship relationship. So he goes into the shack, and there's a lot of provisions in the shack too, you know, more ammunition, you know, fresh water, some guns. There's also a stack of dynamite. So they make the comment, oh, I guess he poaches and he fishes with dynamite. But while they're arguing with this one-armed Cajun hunter, Poole, like you said, loses it. He paints a cross on his chest and he lights the cabin on fire, which we all know as viewers is a really bad idea. And then he kind of walks out of there like, haha, I burned their cabin down. And then someone says, there was dynamite in there, and then the cabin blows up. So he kind of ruins like their chance of like resupply right there, and just ramps up the stress and the tension in the group.
Right, because they would have been much better off with the supplies in that cabin. But now they've got a prisoner that they're dragging mm-hmm. with them. So you're the Cajun hunters, the other Cajuns, now their buddy's been kidnapped by these soldiers that stole their canoes, shot at them. Yeah, and they mm-hmm. still don't know their blanks, right?
Right.
They've done all this. So, I mean, you can't blame the Cajuns for coming after them at all. And now their buddy's been kidnapped by these soldiers, right?
Right.
You know, it's funny because Coach later on, he comes up to Spencer and Hardin and he had painted this, like you say, the red cross on there. And they're like, what's the deal with a cross? And he's like, oh, it's like the avenging angel. I thought you would get it, Spencer. And Spencer just looks at him. And when he walks off, Hardin says, you know, he's crazy. And Spencer goes, yeah, we all know that. And Hardin's like, no, and Spencer's like, well, what can I do about it? You know, you want me to shoot him or lock him up? And Hardin says, either one's fine by me.
I love that too, because that's I think it's a really good direction and screenwriting there, because while the other guys, you could hear the other guys talking and do blah, 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 but you also have like almost cut scenes with Spencer and Hardin, like as sort of ongoing color commentary of the kind of, I don't know. We want to keep this PG.
Yeah, we're going to try to keep these PG, so we're not
right. So the comedy of errors that has become this expedition, right?
Yeah. So they're going along, and now as they're moving along now, and they've got the prisoner with them, which, you know, and you talk about the comedy errors, they're like, tie him up. He's only got one arm. What do I tie it to? You know, stuff like that.
I know.
But as they're moving,
it's great dialogue that just makes, you know, it's kind of like dark humor, right? Almost like because what they're not trying to be funny, they're just saying things that like in that situation make it very ironic. And if you like that kind of humor, and that sarcasm and that kind of dark ironic humor, this movie, you'll love this movie really well. So like,
and it feels
Spencer, Spencer, see, they named the main character after Spencer of, you know, Free Thrall, of Keep on the Keep Off the Borderlands. So he'd love this movie because it's very cheeky. I mean, they don't have British accents, but you know,
they well, he's supposed to be that Southern gentleman to some degree, right? Was what Spencer's supposed to be, but he's like somebody you could see in Mosby's Raiders or riding with mm-hmm. Jeb Stuart in the Confederate War. Right? That's kind of what they're going for. But not necessarily like but you know, just that kind of personality is what they're going for. But you know, but it's interesting. So we see him move, but I feel the dialogue to drop into that really quickly. I feel the dialogue's pretty natural. I feel he's done a good job writing naturalistic dialogue. And even when we see him camping there at one point, and this is earlier on, we've skipped this part or not skipped, but we already moved past this part of the movie, but Coach comes up to Cribs and is talking to him one night and the others are playing cards and stuff. Cribs is African-American soldier and Coach is kind of trying to connect with him, and Cribs is smoking a joint at that time. He smoked marijuana, and Coach is giving him a hard time. And so Cribs starts telling him, I sell pot to high school kids, because Coach is a high school coach. Yeah. But you could see that happening. Like, honestly, I mean, I've been around growing up. I was around National Guard folks. When I was in high school, one of my buddies' father was a first sergeant for a National Guard unit. And we actually went up with them to Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania and pretended we were new, you know, because we were in JRTC in high school. So we had uniforms and all that. So we went up and we're just new. We haven't been off to basic yet. And we played National Guard for the weekend and stuff. And being around them, this movie honestly feels very realistic to the Guard of that era. Not necessarily to today, but for the late 70s. And this is set in 73, but it was shot in 81. That late 70s, early 80s Guard, this feels, from just my experience, feels right. It's just like Rambo First Blood, or actually it was First Blood when it came out. The Guard you see in First Blood feels realistic to me. At the time, you know, the way they acted and did everything, it felt right to me.
It kind of makes sense, right? Because these are people that, you know, like only Poole, they're all of age, but it seems like only Poole actually served in Vietnam. So you really have a lot of these National Guards before, you know, a lot of veterans become or join part of the National Guard and the reforms of the 80s. Like, a lot of these National Guardsmen are like kind of like people that might be not have fought in Vietnam and then have joined the Guard. So they're not as, really, they're not as disciplined, I would say, is a general thing, until like you get a more influx of veterans who fought in war and saw conflict into the Guard. And then there was actually some reforms in the 80s of the structure and the way the National Guard operated. So I think it is great. I agree. It really is a good depiction of that. And so maybe that's why the Iran kind of liked it.
So we'll talk about that at the end. But so one thing we see here, you mentioned that, you know, you got these people that are there that maybe aren't, you know, have a lot of service and combat and stuff. So when is they're walking along after they leave and they're bringing their prisoner with them, you get a shot of them going along. Now, we're not shown Hardin, but the characters were shown. The only one actually observant and looking around and looking for threats is Reese. All the others are just kind of looking ahead or just going. And this is where they come up to the bear traps. They come up to this.
I thought the dogs.
No. You're right. This is where they come up to the rabbits.
Okay. Yeah. They hear the rabbits.
Yep.
Yeah. They have the rabbits, and there's like, you know, symbolically, there is like the same number of rabbits as there are, you know, soldiers. And they're like, oh, what does this mean? Other, you know, the kind of stuff. And then it becomes like a little bit of a cat and mouse, and they send dogs after them only to kind of, you know, and I thought there were going to be some, the dogs actually do a number on these guys, right? Because
these are hunting dogs.
Yeah. Like they're like bears. Big mastiffs. Yeah. They're actually all Rottweilers. They're all Rottweilers, by the way.
Yeah. But
they're
hunting dogs.
Yeah. They're hunting dogs.
They're to hunt bear and things, or hogs or stuff like
hogs that. Hogs and gators. Yeah. Stuff like that. Bark at snakes and stuff like that, but they do a number on them. Like, several of these dudes get injured and they have limited ammo, so they really want to save the ammo for like the human threat, so they try to fend off the dogs with like the butts of their guns and stuff like that, and the dogs eventually run off, but it's like it's almost like it's pre-planned because the dogs are and then there's the trees fall down and you could
tell. Before that, you're skipping ahead here, so okay. So the dogs are sicked on him, and yeah, and the dogs go off. They keep going. They come across these seven bear traps.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, and there's a question, but and these are set out in plain view, even right. though Sergeant Casper almost walks into them. Somebody has to grab him to so he doesn't step on them. But they're not cut, but they are in plain view. But there are only seven, not eight of them, which they have a little discussion. Why only seven? But at this point, obviously, we as the viewer, well, we as experienced role players know that those are made, they're a diversion, right? They're yeah. supposed to see that. So when they go off the trail, they're going to step into the hidden traps, but yeah. which is exactly what they do. They mm-hmm. they get off, they go off the main area that, or trail they're following. They go off, and unfortunately, poor Cribs walks into, you know, a spike trap pops up.
Takes spike Cribs spear traps.
And that's when they cut the trees, because once they're sitting there around Cribs' body and they're all yeah. in this central area of the swamp, the Cajuns mm-hmm. start dropping trees to pin them in, because they yeah. want to pin them in so they can shoot.
They want to direct them or pin them in. Yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah, yeah. And so now we have a now we're on the run, because we're running as these trees are dropping, mm-hmm. and we're trying to not be trapped in this right. cage of trees.
Yeah,
great action scene. Yeah,
it's really good. It's very tense. Again, it's very cat and mouse. Eventually, the squad escapes, or the remainder of the squad, because they've lost two people now, escapes yep. the camp for the night. And then Bowden kind of loses it even more. He breaks down, refuses to talk to anybody. And they tie him up too. So now they have like two prisoners. And then in the morning, Harden awakens and he sees Reese torturing the one-armed Cajun, like trying to torture him with water, like trying to drown him. And then they get into a fight to the death with bayonets, you know, and then Harden gains the upper hand. The Cajun screams in English, but you knew all along, I think, that yeah. he probably yeah. knew English. He's just messing with these guys. He screams in English and Harden kills Reese. So you've got the quote unquote the best hunter killed, you know. So it's almost like they killed the leader and they kill like their best fighter, you know.
And the prisoner escapes. The trapper runs off.
Yep.
So now they bury. Now they have three that they and they end up burying them because they can't carry three bodies.
Yeah.
So they bury them, and now we and have that.
Stucky wants to kill Harden because Reese was Stucky's buddy, and Casper mm-hmm. says, "Nah, we'll court martial him." That seems to. But then they start mutinying against Casper, right? So.
Right. Well, you have this power struggle, and Harden tells Spencer, "Hey, you need to take charge. You need to do a coup." And Spencer's like, no, you know, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, then it comes up. I forget what causes it, but then but shortly after that, it comes to a head and Spencer takes over.
Yeah.
He does take over.
Yeah. And then they have an actual direct altercation with the Cajuns where there is a bit of a firefight. Yep. And Harden actually potentially, he might have killed one of them. It looks like he kills one.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of not clear, but he shoots and the guy falls down. So who knows?
Right. He at least hit one of them.
Yeah. And then there's a helicopter passes overhead and the soldiers are trying to, because I guess at this time, because Spencer had said, like someone said, oh, they're going to look for us, right? This earlier on. And Spencer kind of gave this really neat, like, breakdown of National Guard procedure. Or military procedure in general in the situation, but specifically National Guard, and said, oh, they're not going to come looking for us till tomorrow anyway. So, right. But I guess they are looking for them because see this military helicopter fly over. They start running, you know, headlong through the swamp, trying to flag it down. And then we quickly lose like three people. So,
right. Stucky, well, so Stucky takes off, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. After it, he gets separated from the party. Because yeah. this is why the rest of the party separates. Stucky gets separated. Right. He gets in quicksand.
Yeah. So he like disappears. And right. they're like, oh my God, the Cajuns took him. Who knows? And then the other two, the factions split up.
Yeah.
Right. And then Casper makes a homemade grenade somewhere. He made it earlier and he throws it at the Cajuns. Then he loses it. He fixes his bayonet and charges at him and they gun him down. And then Sims breaks down. He loses control. He starts weeping, and he is killed as well. So you lose three people quickly, and then it's only Spencer, Harden, and Bowden.
Right.
And now we've lost three people.
Yeah, Bowden's coach, if you're following.
Yeah, Bowden is coach. Yeah, he's the one who's he's catatonic and been tied up also. And then they eventually, I guess the Cajuns either give up the chase or they're planning something else. But these three guys managed to find a place to camp.
Right. Well, as I say, they finally fall asleep. And mm-hmm. ironically, it's near a railroad, although they don't know it. So Spencer and Hardin wake up to hear the train go by, and we don't see Bowden or coach. Mm-hmm. As they walk over to look at the train, they see Bowden's body hanging from the train trestle. And then after the train passes, the one-armed Cajun is up there with a rifle on the little bridge. And he tells them, he tells them he doesn't want to kill him, but his friends aren't as nice as him. And they need to get out. If they, go this way, they'll hit the bayou, hit a road, and be able to get out.
Yeah.
And when they try to find out, did you guys kill Bowden? He says, you don't need to ask questions. You just need to get out of here.
So they follow his advice, and they end up hitching a ride with a friendly Cajun couple, and they think they're taking them to Catahoula. That's their like end goal. But instead they take them to a nearby Cajun village to participate with a pig roast. And actually it's kind of a lighthearted scene in the midst of all this like death and killing and thriller action. And Spencer, who's very gregarious anyway, mixes with the villagers, but Hardin then sees the other trappers, the three remaining trappers arrive at this place. Cause this seems like a Cajun hangout. They're having a pig roast. They're very graphic about slicing up the pigs, dissecting the pigs. I'm sure there's some sort of symbolism there, but anyway, so Hardin sees the hunters arrive. With dogs. Right.
Yeah, with dogs. So the hunters get all this time, Spencer keeps telling Hardin, don't be paranoid. You're too paranoid. Nothing's going to happen to us here. But as Hardin's watching, he sees them throw two ropes over this thing, with nooses. And he thinks they're setting up to hang them, although they're actually just going to hang the pigs to slaughter.
To slaughter them.
But he thinks they're going to hang them. And he's, like you say, he sees the hunters come back and eventually Hardin kind of takes a knife off the table and he goes out and he tries to leave the little settlement, but one of the Cajun hunters actually steps out and so he runs back and then we end up that Spencer goes after Hardin to try to find him. And we have this confrontation in the little settlement so everybody else is partying. And I guess the music's so loud they don't hear the gunshots.
And they kind of go back and forth in the scene, like between the partying and the dancing and the singing, and then the little fight and chase scene between the hunters and Spencer and Hardin.
Yeah, which is great. Very well done. Finally, Spencer and Hardin break contact. They're able to get out, and they're going. They see the helicopter again, so they're following the helicopter, and they come up to a road and they see what appears to be a convoy of army trucks, or at least two trucks there on the road. And that's when we hit slow motion for like last 20 seconds or 30 seconds of the movie. Yeah. And then that's it.
And then it's seemingly they do get away after they deal with these hunters. I guess Hardin is pretty badly injured. He gets actually shot in the arm. Yeah. And then he has to kill. He's like on the ground. And then the other hunters and Spencer catches up with them after he smacks a guy in the face. And then, when he's going to shoot, he has Spencer dead to rights, the hunter, and Hardin stabs him in the groin, and then they escape, happens what Jason said, they kind of get out. Although they don't show you until the very end in slow motion, like the star of the U.S. Army trucks. They're like, oh no, this is more Cajuns that have corralled poor Hardin and Spencer. So they leave it tense until the very end. And then you really don't know. There's no there's no like denouement, right, where you see Hunter and Spencer sitting in a bar and talking about it. They just kind of leave it in that slow motion scene.
Right. So we don't really know this. It's kind of left open a little bit ambiguous. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what happened is in the late 80s. So that's the movie. Really quickly, we've been talking about the Iranian cut. In the late 80s, this movie was recut, not with permission, but the Iran's government, who it, you know, at this point, we had really bad relations with Iran, you know, for the past decade. And so they shortened the movie to 95 minutes. They recalled it Operation Lagoon, and they, you know, redubbed everything, and they made it look like the way they redubbed it, their version of the movie are the squad are people that are opposed to a troop that are opposed to Vietnam. And so they're sent in the swamps to be killed by manhunters hired by the U.S. government to kill the squatted deserters effectively. Right. And so at the end of the movie, what happens is when they get to the trucks, it goes black and then you hear a bunch of gunfire. And the assumption is the U.S. government troops have shot these guys. And the whole thing is the idea the U.S. government set these soldiers are opposed to Vietnam, and the U.S., you know, set them up to be hunted and then killed them. And it was a big hit in Iran. Apparently of the Iranians loved it. The critics loved it. Huge hit.
That's the point.
So,
all right. Okay. So now we get to talk. I think it's a really good movie. It was very enjoyable, as you can tell, you know, by Jason and I discussing it very excitedly. So I guess we get to the next set of questions you have for this discussion.
Yeah. And before we do that, any thoughts on any final thoughts on this film? Maybe. So I kind of, it's not a perfect movie. Like you say, there maybe could be a little bit shorter, this and that, but overall, I think it's a really strong movie. I think there's a strong thriller. This is as close to a horror movie as Walter Hill's directed up to this point. But I think it's effective. I think it, you know, for me, when I rewatched it, I was engaged the whole time. I think we have great characters. I think, you know, there's something happening every 5-10 minutes, you know, even though it seems like a long time, it's still pretty quick. Or not pretty quick, but it, like you mentioned in the beginning, the plot's moving. So you're not bored during this movie, I don't think.
No, not at all. Yeah. And I think it definitely deserves a rewatching, because there's some things you mentioned that I kind of missed, like Bowden causing the boats to tip over and stuff like that. But yeah, it's good rewatching, especially for the dialogue, I think, to really, really, it's a pretty tight movie in that regard. Like, I don't think any dialogue is wasted, because everything contributes to character development or the plot to push things forward. Right. So, so just, you know, it's a really well done. I thought it was a really well done movie. I was surprised, actually.
So if we had to give recommendations, I mean, I give this 2 thumbs up. I don't know about.
Yeah, I would give it 2 thumbs up. It's definitely worth watching. It probably is not quite a like totally prone movie in the M.W. Lewis parlance, but it's close. Right. Maybe a lean against the couch, you know, the couch arm.
Right. So the one elephant in the room we haven't mentioned that I'm just going to read, we don't need to get into it, but at the beginning of this, Walter Hill made a statement, and Walter Hill said that we're very aware that people are going to see this as a metaphor for Vietnam. The day we hit the cast read before we went into the swamps, I told everybody, people are going to say this about Vietnam. They can say whatever they want, but I don't want to hear another word about it. So this is something, obviously, you can look at it as a Vietnam metaphor. You can read into it. But just like with Lord of the Rings and the World Wars, it's something the reader or the viewer is reading into it, not what the author is intentionally writing.
Yeah, I mean, really, I think it's like this is what happens when you just go into a territory or a place that doesn't belong to you and just feel like you own it and take stuff that shouldn't belong to you, because that's how everything spirals down, right? Really, they kind of dismiss that this is not their territory, that this is a Cajun territory, and they're disrespectful, and then there's consequences because of that.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think you nailed
it. Has nothing to do with Vietnam. It just, you know, the lesson learned here is like, if I get lost in the swamp, I'm going to be nice to everyone.
Definitely. Yeah. So that said, if you're going to watch this as a double feature, what movie would you pick? And I would ask, we can talk about other movies, but give me just one movie at first. What movie would you pair this for a double feature?
I think because it's so like action thriller and serious and deadly, I think I would pair it with Stripes.
Really? That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, yeah, it's a military movie. Yeah. Came out at the same time. You probably could in 1981 find like some of these theaters, at least when I was growing up, some of my theaters would do like as a special double feature on a Sunday or Saturday matinee. And they would probably wrap these two movies together just because they're both military movies. And I kind of did this, I mentioned it on the Discord, but I saw Alien and Zordaz in this. So two sci-fi movies, one very serious and one very, you know, kind of lighthearted. So that's, I think, a good choice to do because Stripes is totally off the wall. Still, I think they're still National Guardsmen, right? So you could put them together. Are they regular military or National Guard?
I don't remember. I mean, they end up in Germany, right? Yeah. Later on when they have the RV.
The RV, yeah. It's a very campy, but classic Bill Murray, top Bill Murray. Yeah.
I think.
I would just because like, man, you're like at the end, you're like, oh man, it's with that ambiguous ending. Did they get out? I don't know. Everyone got killed. That was pretty brutal. Okay, let's watch Stripes now. That's the way I would see it.
So that's interesting. So I went the opposite direction. I was looking for something with the same feel as this. And depending what you had picked, I have a couple movies here that have the same feel. But I'll give something slightly different, I think, would work well with this. And then we can talk about ones with the same feel. Mm-hmm. But I think you could match this up with Predator, to be honest. I think it would match up pretty well with Predator.
Mm-hmm.
As a, you know, maybe what, I don't know what order you'd watch them in, because Predator is a more upbeat to some degree, you know, because a more modern filming style. But I think it would go with that well with that. Did you have other ones? Because I've got a couple others, but did you have other ones you were thinking of?
Well, because of the similarities with Deliverance, I think it would maybe watch Deliverance with that too. But that'd be the same vein, right? Going to a territory that's not your own. You know, be disrespectful to the locals and you suffer the consequences.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of the same kind of plot almost. And there are a lot of comparisons to that 1972 John Borman Deliverance movie.
Right. So another movie before this that's similar, I don't know if you ever seen this, in 1975, there's a movie called Race the Devil. Have you ever seen that?
No, never seen that.
So Race the Devil is actually a pretty cool movie. It's got Peter Fonda, Warren Oates, Loretta Swift, oh, wow. What's her name? Big Lips or Hot Lips from MASH. Yeah. But Race the Devil, what happens is we have basically this couple and they're like motorcycle racers or whatever. And they've got an RV motorcycles in the back and they're out in the California, you know, out in the back country. And they come across a satanic ritual and then the Satanists chase them for the rest of the movie. Highly recommended. So it's a little different because it's Satanists chasing them and Satanic cultists instead of Cajuns, but it's the same kind of idea, right? And you don't know who you can trust, and it's Race the Devil. I would recommend another one kind of like that was Judgment Night. Do you remember Judgment Night?
No.
Okay, so Judgment Night is a 1993 movie with Emilio Estevez, Cuba Gooding Jr. Dennis Leary, they rent an RV and they're going to a ball game in Chicago and they get off.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, I've seen that.
Gang chases them and they're running from the gang on foot and they're like trying to hide from the gang the whole movie. That movie pairs with this well too.
Yeah, it could. I think it could. That's cool.
Yeah, so those are the two I was although they're pretty similar in nature, but those are the two I was kind of thinking of. Given that kind of horror, suspense, thriller kind of vibe.
I guess if you wanted to go Keith Carradine, you could throw in The Duelist or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
With the, so, you know, it's a 1977 period of drama for those who don't know, directed by Ridley Scott, which is interesting, set during the Napoleonic War. So, if you're doing a Keith Carradine night, that would be a good one to go with.
I think. Or The Long Riders.
Or Long Riders.
You know, another great movie. So if you were going to play this as a game, and I guess this is kind of a dual question because it's one thing if you're doing this as an ongoing game, but the answer, if you're doing it as a one shot might be different, but
right. If
you're going to run this as a game, as a role-playing game, what system would you use, Carl?
Well, I tend to answer T2K for everything, but you're muted, but I think, Yeah, I think that because of the rising and ratcheting tension, and it's more civilian in scope, I think I would actually use Walking Dead. And also because I think T2K, the new T, I'm talking about the fourth edition of T2K, although first and second edition is very similar vein. If you're in the military, you're pretty competent. And I think a Walking Dead with the D6, six only success dice pool mechanic of Mutant Year Zero engine, it can lend more to messing up a lot. And that's part of the Walking Dead mechanic. There's also the ratcheting of stress. And I think when my wife Amy and I were watching this, we're like, oh, increase stress. Oh, you can increase stress. So we could see like where this could you could increase the tension very quickly and kind of treat the Cajuns as like zombies in the Walking Dead, that they're not, they're more of a, I mean, I guess when you get to like actual fights, you fight it out or whatever, but they're kind of more of a hazard, as you know, and the things that they run into are more of a hazard because of the environment as opposed to actual direct combatants. But there's that as well. So I think Walking Dead would work really well. The Walking Dead mechanic, of course, no zombies and stuff, but like I said, substitute the Cajun environment for like the zombie threat, and you could really ratchet that up. I think that would work really well.
So for me, of course, for any modern game, Cyberpunk 2020 is kind of my go-to. It has a coolness under fire mechanic. It has you could use the cyber psychosis mechanic with some house rolling to do. But you want something where they're increasingly the question is, so well, I'll go through these and we'll have a quick discussion. But then I thought, if you're doing a one shot, do you really need all those mechanics going on? Do you need a full character, a full page character, and all this stuff just for a one shot? And so that then I thought something like 2 Hour War Games FNG, which is it's a role playing light game. It's a skirmish game, but it's a Vietnam game. But it has rules in there where you have to react under fire and stuff. That or FGU's Merc, which is an early role playing game of mercenaries. That also has that kind of thing. Merc also has interesting rules where when you do command checks, if the person in command fails, then everybody has to make additional stress checks. And you could give your commanders, like in this case, we could give Sergeant Casper a very low command rating, so he's more likely to fail those command checks. Zoser's Grunt is another Vietnam game that has stress mechanics and building stress mechanics. It's fairly light. But I think for a one shot, honestly, because the gear and all that stuff really doesn't matter that much in this. It's more the pressure and the tension and all that. I think I'd use one of the games set up for a horror one shot, like Slasher Flick or Dead of Night. I think both those, because they have like stress mechanics, they have freak out mechanics, and they're designed as a one shot. I think both of those, so the system's a lot lighter. I think they might be better because I can't see this being an ongoing campaign. This is a
No, it seemed
one
like
and
a
done.
one shot, like I guess in the parlance of like Walking Dead or Alien, it's like a cinematic scenario, right? It's a one shot, not meant for a campaign, because really, like, I mean, and I guess for me, like I was thinking, like I think you'd be hard pressed, in my experience. Maybe you have nicer gamers. In my experience, you'd be hard pressed to get gamers to follow along and follow along. Fall in line, I guess, because no one was really, none of these people are really killers, right? They're like on the back end of the violence most of the time, right? And I mean, the only one who's really a killer or someone who has violent tendencies, but then again, Spencer says he only thinks he is Reese, right? Because he's like, but other than that, these, and maybe Pool, but he gets, I mean, I would have Pool like as an NPC, like to get taken out early anyway. But most of these guys, they're not, their first instinct is not to kill another person. So I don't know. I think you'd have a hard time. And I think Grunt is a good one, because I remember reading in Grunt that it really talks about like most people have empathy, and it really breaks down over the course of like a war time situation. But most people start off with empathy. They don't want to kill another person. I know that T2K has a mechanic where you can't like kill a helpless person, and for generally speaking, and you're really reluctant to do that. And Walking Dead, I think you have you can build in like tags into Walking Dead, and I think I don't know if you can with Grunt, but maybe some of the horror games you definitely can, where they have flaws that suggest that you're not a killer. And I think that's where I would say be hard pressed to run this as a scenario, because most players default to Murder Hobo in my experience.
Right. I think for this to work, for any horror game, or even really a suspense thriller to work in an RPG, the players have to buy in, right? They have to buy into the stereotypes and be willing to do that. The tough thing here, and that's kind of why it ended up defaulting in the end to the horror games, because the horror games let you go from fully sane to losing it and you know, breaking down mentally in one session. Where a lot of these other games, those mechanics are there, but they're meant to happen over a series of sessions.
Yeah.
It's a slow fall, a slow drop, right?
Yeah, that's why I like Walking Dead, because you can really, like, at some point you're rolling so many stress dice, it's inevitable you're going to mess up, and that leads to more stress, and it compounds, right? And that's kind of, but Walking Dead is kind of a horror-ish game, horror survival. So I think that kind of works into, but, right, so I think you'd have to, I mean, you might be able to force players to buy in too, because you know, oh, you only got 20 rounds of ammo. If you make Casper an NPC, he's the one who tells you, okay, you only got 2 bullets, right?
Right. So at that point, So, but that brings up the question. What's interesting, and obviously, you're not going to just try to do it exact duplicate of the movie.
Yeah, I know.
You have to change things up. But that said, the way we see these characters go out in this, do you let the player, and this would really depend on your players, because it's obviously more satisfying to let the player play out when they lose it, let the player play that out, as opposed to the GM taking control of the character. But you'd have to have and you could get away with that, like where what's his name runs in the quicksand, where Stucky runs in the quicksand. You can get away with it because, oh, you're going to run. Okay, I run this. You know, oh, you fell in the quicksand, die. But some of these might be a little more. Well, I don't know all these though, because Casper breaks and he charges the enemy. Sims just breaks down. So I guess you could, like, when we think of Call of Cthulhu, like what happens when you go insane, these things. I guess most of the Coach Bowden's is a little bit more. Well, although he eventually goes catatonic, which is kind of in there. So you can definitely simulate this different ways, but ideally you'd have players that buy in, because it's much better if they're playing than breaking down than you mechanically make them do it.
Right.
So I don't think that would work as well.
Yeah. And that's why I like some of these, like the more, I haven't looked at the new Green Ronin Cthulhu game, but apparently they do that where the player has more agency on how they lose it. Or, you know, and I think Walking Dead, in my experience, when we played it, like, it's more like a tag. So, you know what you messed up in. These are some suggestions. What happens? And that's kind of what I did with the players. Like, when they messed up, I'm like, okay, this is what you're trying to do. And you messed up. So, you know, what happened? Right. So I think the more modern games take that into consideration, so the player can narrate, like, how, you know, when they do lose it, or because inevitably that's going to happen in a horror game. I mean, well, clearly Spencer and Harden didn't lose it, so they kind of maintained their quote unquote sanity in this scenario, or they kept it together the most, right? There are probably a couple times where they do lose it, like when Harden goes up against Reese, but that could be simulated as, like, this is part of your morality. You're like, you're not going to let someone torture someone, and you're going to say something about it. And of course, Reese is like, well, gets mad about that.
Reese would need to be an NPC. Yeah. So the other question is, do you do this with a full table and just with the understanding, and we have to let people know ahead of time, listen, there's one shot, character's going to die in it, and then just people die and they're gone? Or do you do this with just a few players and you do it almost like a funnel, where you give each player they have one main character and then they have some secondary characters?
Yeah. That's a question, right? Who would you have? I mean, I guess you could have, ideally you would have 2 people, and then those are the people that could survive. But similarly, like someone like Sims.
You want Sims somebody to play them, though. I mean,
yeah. That's true. It's more satisfying if you play them.
Right.
But then I guess you would mechanically, you'd lower their stats such that, you know, if you're playing, say, Call of Cthulhu or something, you lower their stats such that they would go, they would lose sanity quicker. You could do that, but
well, when some of these horror games do that, where they give you,
I've seen some Delta Green scenarios. I've seen Delta Green scenarios where, like, oh, this person's really good at fighting, but he has a tendency to break under pressure, you know, type of thing. Mm-hmm. That kind of balance things out. A great scenario that does that. That's a poker night by Delta. So I would highly recommend that as an intro to Delta Green, because you're not even part of the conspiracy yet. But Poker Night is a great kind of game where you could play anyone, any of the characters in it, because they have different, you know, abilities and different vulnerabilities. So I think that's probably the way to do it. See, I think you would have, I mean, you could even have Reese as a PC, right? You just give them, and you could do like what is done in Alien or other games, like a great, like a Savage Worlds in you know what I'm talking about. The Savage Worlds game where you play mobsters.
Oh, yeah. And Wise Guys.
Wise Guys, where everyone has like a little agenda. You know, you kind of give them their secret agenda, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, right.
If you make Reese a character, you're like very easily, easily insulted is like a flaw or trait or, you know, whatever they.
Well, some of these
Hindrance in the Savage Worlds parlance.
Some of these horror games give you where you have a main character and you have secondary characters. And you already know that. So we know it going into this that some of these characters are secondary characters. So, and that way you can have people die along the way. But mm-hmm. so each player is playing two or three characters, but they have one primary and a couple we know that are going to, you know, buy it pretty early on. But there are different ways to do it.
So I think maybe because they do things that are contribute to the plot directly, I think maybe Bowden and Poole would be the only ones that would be definitely, I would suggest, would be NPCs.
Well, yeah, as long as you have players I agree. If you have players that totally bought in and were with it, you could mm-hmm. definitely, and you're doing a one shot, everybody understands that there might be PvP and they're going to have mm-hmm. conflicts, right. Then Reese, you could definitely have as a PC. Mm-hmm.
But there could even be a situation where Reese says, like, no way am I giving up my ammo. But then you play it out and see what happens, right?
Right.
Right. If Casper is another player, then he says, well, I order you, and then it could be a fight. And then, well, there's a scenario right there. The Cajuns are sitting back smoking their pipes and laughing as these guys kill each other, right?
Yeah.
They win. 100%. The Cajuns win. Would you have the one-armed Cajun as a player character?
No, definitely not. Yeah, I wouldn't have any of the Cajuns. I don't think you want to have that. I think the ability not to communicate with them and have them not involved, I think is for this particular, if I was doing this as a scenario, I wouldn't want that. In a different kind of game, maybe. Because like if you did Predator, you might have, I forget her name now, but the actress that they meet up in the jungle, you know, the lady they meet up in the jungle, I could see her being a PC.
Right.
And what I would do with that is I would have that player playing one of the squad members that's killed, and then they come across her, and that player who just lost a character would take up that character. But in this case,
I've done that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in this case, the occasions or even the trapper, the one-armed trapper is never part of the group.
Right.
They do that in Alien.
And Alien does that a really good way in some of the cinematic scenarios where, if you lose this character, because everyone's like, it's a cinematic scenario going in. So some of us may die, but mm-hmm. if you lose a character early on, you can pick up one of the NPCs.
No, definitely. I mean, there are times you might play a prisoner. Like if you were doing like Assault on Precinct 13, mm-hmm. then obviously that character, you know, the prisoner character, the Lawrence Fishburne played him in the remake, and who plays him is Darwin Jetson plays him in the Johnson, mm-hmm. if I can say it, played him in the original. But in Assault on Precinct 13, that prisoner there you would have as part of the group, right?
Yeah.
But it is a PC. But I don't think I'd do it in this one, but.
Okay.
Well, thank you, though. I appreciate you coming on to discuss all this.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really good. I think it's so funny how I watch movies nowadays. I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but then I'm always like, how can I game this? How can this, I change it into a game, or how could I run this as a scenario? And I think it's really a fun exercise to do. I mean, even if you never do it, just to think about it, and to think of how you would handle the situation, how players might react, is kind of a fun exercise. So, and of course, the movie was really fun to watch too. So I'm really glad I got to revisit and watch this movie again.
I hadn't seen this for a few years, so I was happy to revisit it. And I was really happy when you picked it as your pick, because it's a fun movie, and I think more people should go out and see this. I kind of have a feeling this is one, like you say, though, it was on HBO a lot during the 80s. I feel, but
It didn't do well commercially, and Walter Hill was kind of pissed off about that, right? So he has some pretty graphic quotes about that. But it didn't do well commercially. Maybe there was like a lot of backlash because people like, oh, another Vietnam War movie, because it's not sold as that at all. But I mean, it kind of, if you watch the opening scene, you're like, oh, is this about Vietnam? Because you don't know where you are yet, you know?
Right. Well, and they kind of, so, you know, in the trailer does mention Apocalypse Now as well. So it's, mentions Deliverance and Apocalypse Now. So, they were probably trying to, obviously they're trying to get audience in the seats, but I definitely think, folks, if you haven't seen this, it's worth watching. It's a good movie. It's a good character study. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting little thriller that, does move along pretty well. So,
yep.
Well, Carl, thank you so much, folks. Check out everything Carl does. He's got YouTube channel. He and Amy have a YouTube channel and a podcast and all kinds of stuff. All those links to everything Carl and the Gemologist Presents will be in the show notes. So check that out. And with that, I'm going to bid everybody adieu. So thank you to Carl for joining me. Thank you to TJ for the music. And I just want to remind everybody to be excellent to each other.
Your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.